My name is Reed Stevens, and I'm joined by my colleague here in Washington, D.C., Amin Sidhu. And we're going to take you through fraud and abuse issues in life sciences transactions. Next slide, please. Next slide. Thanks. So our agenda is going to cover a lot of ground. This is going to be more of a survey. We're going to drill down on a few key topics, but we want to cover a lot of ground because the subject matter of transactions and fraud and abuse in life sciences is a very broad one. For those who are more healthcare oriented, of course, healthcare issues tend to be around the delivery of healthcare services, treating patients with illnesses, that sort of thing. Whereas life sciences is focused more on transactions, manufacturing products, and then delivering them down a distribution and supply chain. And so the issues that we're going to cover today are going to really touch on many aspects of that distribution chain, which is where these opportunities for fraud and abuse allegations and compliance issues, this is where they crop up. So our agenda is going to start with current trends in life sciences M&A, with M&A, of course, being just one type of transaction that we're going to talk about. Then we're going to give you an overview of fraud and abuse laws, particularly ones that have been subject to recent enhancements, changes, reforms. Then we're going to spend a fair amount of time on the enforcement landscape and case law developments, of which there have been a number of important developments in the last several months. Now, we have a new administration, the Biden administration, and we've got a Senate that has a Democratic majority, along with the House majority. So we're going to talk about the priorities of the Biden administration, the Democratic congressional majorities, and the states, which are always very active on life sciences issues, particularly relating to pharma. Then we're going to spend some time on risk-based assessments in structuring transactions in life sciences. We're going to give you an overview of where in the HHS-OIG work plan some priorities were identified that are relevant for drug, device, and diagnostic companies. We're going to talk about copay assistance and patient access issues, which are always relevant. And then we'll talk on value-based contracting and some of the concerns that can arise there. Next slide, please. So fraud and abuse risk management is a top priority for all of us who are engaged on behalf of our clients in helping them navigate safely the distribution supply chain. So we're going to talk about product development, supply chain integrity. We're going to talk about patient access issues involving third parties that implicate anti-kickback issues. Drug pricing is always a very important hot topic. As I mentioned, value-based contracting is a new delivery model that is being tried out and tested for drugs and devices. Manufacturing, GMP records integrity considerations. Opioids, prescribing, and the marketing fallout that continues to reverberate. HCP consulting agreements that implicate anti-kickback statute considerations. Off-label promotion, promotion for unapproved indications, never going away. And then also a spotlight on private equity sponsor exposure for portfolio companies. Next slide. So from a big picture standpoint, you've got continued risks with fraud and abuse exposure. In 2020, the federal government recovered $1.8 billion in healthcare fraud-related settlements and judgments. That number seems staggering, but in context, it's actually lower than in prior years. The trend seemed like it was decreasing slightly, but I think most observers think it's very likely that those numbers will reverse soundly under the Biden administration with a new Department of Justice under new leadership. And so we're going to talk about some of those implications And then on the corporate side, due diligence to evaluate and mitigate risk is critical, whether you're able to do that due diligence pre-acquisition or whether you're doing it post-acquisition. So we're going to cover all those issues as well. So I'm going to turn things over to Amin. And if you have questions, please feel free to interject them in the chat. And also, we're going to be providing CLE credit for this, for your participation today. So at around the midway point, Amin's going to give you the CLE code. And then at the end, I will reiterate the CLE code. So with that, take it away, Amin.
So much, Reid. If we could have the next slide, please. And we can jump to, there we go. Thanks so much, Jordan. So just to extend on some of the points that Reid made in terms of trends that we've seen, particularly in the transactional space, in life sciences, M&A, 2019 was really the year of the mega deal. And in some ways, 2020 saw some pretty substantial transactions, but generally 2020 was the year that was defined by the COVID-19 pandemic. It obviously has impacted every aspect of our lives, and certainly the transactional market in the life sciences space was no stranger. So overall, M&A activity was down 50% over 2019, particularly in the first half of the year. The second half of 2020 saw a significant resurgence of deal-making activity, which really sort of made up for lost time. Just by way of comparison, in the early first quarter of 2020, the deal activity, I think there were 29 or 30 deals that were announced publicly, was on par with prior years. But overall in 2020, there were 79 deals announced versus 92 in 2019. So there was a downtick. But nonetheless, some pretty significant deals in some ways driven by the COVID-19 pandemic in and of itself. The collaboration and interaction between different players, both large and small, was significant. So Gilead's acquisition of Immunomedics for $21 billion, AstraZeneca's proposed acquisition of Alexion Pharma for $39 billion. And then again, the COVID-19-driven transactional activity, Merck's acquisition of Famous and their collaboration with Ridgeback and IAVI, Pfizer's BioNTech collaboration, as folks on the call are likely very familiar, that drove vaccine development. And that collaboration was of course, driven by the pandemic. Next slide, please. So just to level set, we're not going to spend a ton of time digging into the fraud and abuse laws, but did want to give this audience a primer of what the enforcement landscape looks like and what the pitfalls look like, particularly when we're looking at transactions and due diligence and the considerations that must be on your radar during the deal-making process. So. The anti-kickback statute is usually atop the list. This is a criminal statute that prohibits the knowing and willful payment of remuneration to induce referrals. This covers both the payor and the receiver of the alleged kickbacks. There are significant penalties associated with the anti-kickback statute, and it really is the driver of concern when we're looking at fraud and abuse issues in the life sciences space. That ties to the False Claims Act, which, as Reid previewed, is really the primary civil enforcement tool utilized by the federal government in the healthcare and life sciences space. Of the substantial False Claims Act recoveries that the government receives year over year, the overwhelming majority sits in the healthcare and life sciences space. And then civil monetary penalties sometimes come into play. Next slide, please. So looking at the anti-kickback statute, again, as Reid previewed, there have been substantial regulatory changes in recent months. In December of 2020, Department of Health and Human Services, and OIG, and CMS announced very significant changes to the anti-kickback statute, also to the Stark Law and civil monetary penalties. We'll focus on the anti-kickback statute here. In many ways, this was the culmination of a long period of preview of what these final rules would look like. The regulatory sprint to coordinated care that was announced a few years ago drove the announcement of proposed rules, a lengthy notice and comment period, and ultimately the final rules that were announced back in December that go into effect, some of which have gone into effect already, some of which will go into effect later this year. The anti-kickback final rule essentially finalizes a number of exceptions to essentially facilitate the move towards value-based care and value-based enterprises. So in the anti-kickback statute, a number of safe harbors that already exist. With these changes, there are additional safe harbors around care coordination and value-based arrangements with various levels of risk. In some ways, this is focused on the healthcare side of the coin and less on the life sciences component, but there are some notable nuances here that are certainly relevant to the life sciences industry. Next slide, please. So what the Office of Inspector General noted when these new rules were announced for the anti-kickback statute was that there are certain entities, certain players in the healthcare life sciences landscape that present a heightened risk for fraud and therefore are excluded from the value-based safe harbors. Included in those are pharma manufacturers, distributors and wholesalers, PBMs, labs, and manufacturers of devices or medical supplies, as well as medical device distributors. So that's a pretty lengthy list that excludes likely a number of folks that are on this call and a number of entities in the life sciences industry landscape. But notably, durable medical equipment, prosthetics, orthotics, and supplies can be part of a value-based enterprise with certain conditions that are met. And so that's certainly notable. Next slide, please. Next slide. Okay, if we can go back one, I apologize. So again, just looking at the final safe harbors, the beneficiary inducements exception is designed to enhance patient engagement and improve outcomes. Again, entities with a heightened risk of fraud are excluded from the safe harbor. But there is the opportunity for technology exchange. So to the extent that medical supplies, distributors and manufacturers can provide smart tablets to patients, things of that sort. The telehealth technology exception, as we've seen with the significant and unprecedented rise in telehealth in the COVID-19 crisis, that exception is a timely one. And then a cybersecurity exception around the donation of cybersecurity items and services to help address threats. So with the next slide, we'll move into more detail on the enforcement landscape as well as case law developments that we've seen in recent years. So as we've noted, you'll see a common thread that the False Claims Act is the federal government's primary enforcement tool in the civil side. In 2020, of the $2.2 billion that were recovered under the False Claims Act, $1.8 billion of that was in the healthcare and life sciences space. This was a decrease over 2019, and for many years in recent history, there have been over $3 billion in False Claims Act recovery. So this was a downtick over prior years, but a number of substantial settlements, particularly in the life sciences space. Next slide. So a couple of significant settlements, all of these relate to copay assistance issues. As we noted, a point of significant importance for this audience. Novartis Pharma, $591 million combined settlement, essentially two pieces of that settlement. One involved the alleged use of three foundations as conduits for payment of copays for Medicare patients. So this was allegations that Novartis had engaged with these foundations to push for prioritization of payments made for the Novartis drugs that were at issue in terms of the copay donations that were received by patients. The second piece of this, which was the more significant of the two, is the alleged payments of kickbacks to physicians through speaker programs. So this was a traditional kickback model, allegations around honoraria that were paid to physicians, meals, social events, allegations that events that had not taken place. So a traditional kickback model that resulted in a fairly substantial settlement. Two others, both one other with Novartis and another with Gilead Life Sciences combined in the vicinity of $150 million. Both involved alleged improper coordination between the company and copay foundation. So certainly a trend that you can extract from these settlements and others that preceded this activity in 2020, the government's focus and attention on the coordination between drug manufacturers and copay foundations is substantial. And then the final one here is Practice Fusion, $145 million settlement, which was alleged kickbacks involving the exchange of EHR software that was alleged to have increased the volume of opioid prescriptions. So I'm going to pause for a second to see if Reid has anything to add on this particular slide.
Yeah, I would just chime in that we have to keep in mind that these copay assistance, QUITAM allegations, a lot of which, you know, we know are being handled out of the Boston U.S. Attorney's Office, really stem from the government's perspective on drug pricing. And so a lot of this enforcement activity, if you talk to AUSAs who are actively working on these types of matters, they have a really different perspective on how drugs are priced for launch and for success in the marketplace. And when you talk to them about their insistence that the copay assistance model is clearly in their minds one that's very susceptible to fraud, they address the patient access issue simply by kind of baldly saying, well, why don't manufacturers just lower their prices? And so it's a very direct and in some ways, you know, simplified approach to a question that has very complex legal implications. But it's, as Amin said, it's not an issue that's going away because scrutiny on drug pricing, as we'll talk about, you know, later on, is only going to be intensifying.
Thanks so much, Reid. Next slide, please. So going beyond some of the settlements that we saw, there also has been a continued evolution of guidance internally at the Department of Justice and how that has impacted the enforcement landscape. So a lot of the work that, Reid and I do is in the False Claims Act space, litigating and representing defendants in False Claims Act litigation. And much of that activity is driven by whistleblowers. It's driven by QUITAM whistleblowers who file a complaint under seal. It obligates the government to conduct a substantial investigation and either results in litigation with the government or oftentimes directly with the relator or the whistleblower. So as we've seen over time, you know, there's been sort of this shift in guidance around the cases involving whistleblowers. There's also been substantial shifts in guidance around the basis under which allegations can be raised under the False Claims Act. And to that end, the Brand Memo, which was issued in 2018, was really focused on looking at agency guidance. So not just looking at the statutory basis for allegations of fraud, but looking at the sub-regulatory guidance and providing some very clear directives to prosecutors around the country and at Maine Justice around the idea of what is appropriate in terms of the basis for allegations under the False Claims Act. Those types of sub-regulatory guidance, they form the basis for motions to dismiss of cases. So 50 of the 2,000 new cases that were filed since the Brand Memo was issued in 2018, DOJ has filed about 50 motions to dismiss. Again, this is the government stepping in and looking at the complaints filed by whistleblowers and acknowledging that this may be an unlevel playing field for the defendants to be subjected to allegations that get into the weeds of the sub-regulatory guidance. So the Brand Memo was designed to provide a mechanism for those cases to be affirmatively dismissed to avoid continued litigation for the defendants. In practice, it's been a very small percentage, about 2.5% of cases. But the guidance in the Brand Memo was adopted in the Justice Manual. So it went from guidance memo into department policy. And ultimately, it identifies factors that the department will consider after investigating whether this authority to dismiss should be used and under what circumstances. Reid, anything else to add?
Yeah, this is a really important topic for us to explore with you because the False Claims Act has always carried explicit provisions that give the Department of Justice the authority to dismiss QUITAMs if they feel that, public policy isn't served by the case going forward. In other words, simply choosing not to intervene in some instances would be viewed as an insufficient remedy and that the department could actually pull the rug out from under QUITAM whistleblowers to end a case. But it was handled, that power is used very sparingly in the past. When I was in the fraud section years ago, I can't remember a single case during my 8 years where that power was used. And so these agency guidances that came out from the Department of Justice and then also from the Department of Health and Human Services, Office of General Counsel in 2019, a memo was issued that similarly stated that sub-regulatory guidance shouldn't be used as a bludgeon against regulated entities. And so this was definitely an initiative under the past administration, and Senator Grassley, who was effectively the author of the 1986 amendments to the False Claims Act that triggered, you know, the current era of hyperactive FCA enforcement, took the department to task, Department of Justice to task for potentially discouraging whistleblowers from coming forward. But the department forged ahead and, you know, put the brand memo out and has lived it much more vigorously than in the past. But as Amin pointed out, you know, we're talking about 2.5% of 2,000 cases that were filed since the brand memo where the government has moved to dismiss. And with a new administration now in place and a new new leadership moving slowly into place in the Department of Justice, I think we should be prepared for the possibility that this initiative may stall. There may be pressure brought to bear for the executive branch to pull back from using these discretionary authorities to dismiss cases. It's far too early to make a judgment as to what's going to happen, but I think it's important to recognize that we're going to be looking at seismic shifts in enforcement priorities under the new Biden-Harris administration with, you know, a new Department of Justice. Back to you, Amin.
Next slide, please, Jordan. Okay. So this is likely no surprise for folks on the call today. There's an expectation that there will be an ongoing and seemingly endless focus on opioid-related enforcement. This has been going on for many years, and it appears that the various litigation matters, both at the federal and state level around the country, will continue in the coming year and beyond. At the end of 2020, Deputy Assistant Attorney General Michael Granston, in his closing remarks, made it very clear that that there were substantial resolutions in 2020, but that there would be continued focus on this space. So Insys Therapeutics, which was the manufacturer of the sublingual fentanyl spray sepsis, agreed to pay $225 million related to allegations around kickbacks and marketing practices. This was a fairly traditional kickback scheme involving entertainment, meals, and things of the sort. It was sort of a continuation of, again, the focus on substantial settlements that both in some ways took some of the players out of the equation, but in many ways it was just a piece of continued focus, again, in the various state and federal cases that are still pending. There was a separate settlement in the vicinity of $2 billion with Reckitt, Benckiser, and Indivior, involving allegations around their marketing and sale of Suboxone to physicians who are writing prescriptions without a legitimate medical purpose. So again, two substantial settlements, one very significant. But the takeaway here is that between the MDL and the other litigation matters involving opioid manufacturers and distributors, this will continue to be a focus in 2021 and beyond. Next slide.
Before we move on, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the opioid litigations and the prosecutions, in some respects, raise some novel issues about where the government's enforcement discretion is going to be applied. Because the idea that the government's going to prosecute individuals and companies who are writing prescriptions that lack legitimate medical purpose is not surprising, but also surprising at the same time, because obviously if prescriptions are being written for patients that don't have an associated medical condition for the indication, then we would expect there to possibly be some exposure. Where we see prescriptions being written off-label by a physician, there's still no reason to assume that the patient didn't need or couldn't benefit from the prescription if the physician's medical judgment was that it would have been efficacious to prescribe the drug. But it almost seems like in these opioid cases that the government's sort of blown past that threshold and is just assuming that certain pain medications lack a legitimate medical purpose. And I think that is something to really keep an eye on as to whether that type of replacing medical judgment with prosecutorial, prerogatives is going to expand into other therapies, other categories of drugs. It seems like it's not as likely to happen because of the politically charged nature of the opioid crisis. But I think it's worth noting whether or not we start to see more aggressive allegations by the government around physician prescribing.
Thanks, Reid. Next slide. Great. So in terms of additional case law developments, this is something that we think is going to be, it's clearly an emerging trend, but one that is going to capture our attention in 2021 and beyond. And this is the most recently highlighted by the U.S. XREL Drudine versus Carroll Alternatives case out of the Third Circuit. This is a case that is the latest in what is growing circuit split and likely to end up before the Supreme Court in the coming year. This is a case that involved a difference of opinion between a medical expert and a treating physician, and the determination by the court as to whether this was an issue of fact regarding False Claims Act falsity. And what the Third Circuit determined when they reversed the district court decision here was sort of an exacerbation of that emerging circuit split. And this is a case that has a cert petition before the Supreme Court. And the issue here is really whether the medical judgment of physicians can be determined to be false under the False Claims Act and ultimately implicate the False Claims Act prohibition on false or fraudulent billing. So this really goes to the core of physician judgment and second guessing, and the idea of in the context of litigation, having a medical expert question the judgment of the treating physician and the prescribing physician. Next slide. In the cert position, both the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and PhRMA submitted an amicus brief in support of the cert position, and I think this really goes to the core of the issue in terms of the implications, and that is not only the deepening circuit split and the fundamental question around FCA liability, it really goes to the objective falsity question. The adoption of that objective falsity standard, it essentially establish a higher threshold that the government and whistleblowers would need to clear in order to establish neutral claims for medical necessity services that were tainted by fraud and dishonesty. And so in terms of what this means for for the future in terms of a position judgment. It's going to be a significant case. The expectation is that it will likely be taken up by the Supreme Court to resolve the circuit split, and it seems likely to be the next Escobar in terms of the way in which it impacts the landscape of False Claims Act enforcement. Reid, anything to add?
Yeah, I think that what's really interesting to me about this is the connectedness of everything that we've been talking about already. You know, we just got done talking about the Department of Justice and HHS issuing guidance to regulators and enforcers to not be pressing forward with cases that are based solely on a individual or company's lack of compliance with sub-regulatory guidance because of the policy decision that those types of enforcement actions are effectively unfair because the government would be holding parties culpable for not violating laws, but for violating suggestions or recommendations that agencies make relating to the treatment of patients or the choosing of drugs or devices or prescribing of tests that medical professionals are deeming important and necessary. And so this issue about objective falsity really does echo the Escobar line of cases that landed in the Supreme Court a few years ago around the issue of materiality. These issues within the False Claims Act really implicate the same underlying question of if something is necessary because of a medical professional prescribing it, then who is the government to say that it shouldn't be done, that a service shouldn't be provided, that a drug shouldn't be prescribed, that a medical device shouldn't be implanted, that a diagnostic test shouldn't be performed. And so we have this back and forth of litigation, effectively regulation by litigation, to find the outer parameters, the outer perimeter of what is going to be fair game under the False Claims Act, and effectively trying to reel it in. And so the Care Alternatives case, implicating this idea of objective falsity is another opportunity potentially for the defense side to be arguing that medically necessary services should not be subjected to expensive, burdensome, potentially ruinous False Claims Act litigation and potentially criminal prosecutions. We're really going to have to watch these carefully to see whether the Supreme Court takes it up and what the results are and how it gets applied. Because when we look back at how Escobar has been implemented, that has, in fact, spawned a whole new line of cases where district courts are applying the materiality thresholds from Escobar in different ways. And so we could already foresee how objective falsity may be another arrow in the quiver of the defense. But, the question is, will it really result in the truncation of cases early where it really will help defendants avoid the cost, expense, and disruption of a lengthy False Claims Act case?
Thanks, Reid. Next slide. So closing out sort of, an overview of the enforcement landscape, the trends that we anticipate seeing in 2021 and beyond, there continues to be a growing focus on private equity sponsors and the risk that they carry under the False Claims Act. And so certainly relevant to this conversation around life sciences transactions and some of the issues of importance, both pre and post acquisition, it's important to note that there have been substantial enforcement activities, substantial settlements involving private equity sponsors, the most recently coming out of the U.S. X. Earl Johnson versus Therakos case. This was a Johnson & Johnson subsidiary, Medical Device Business Services, agreeing to pay $10 million to settle allegations under the FCA that Therakos had engaged in essentially unapproved use promotion of one of its the ECT product. And so again, here the real issue is, you know, looking to the level of post-acquisition control and involvement that the private equity sponsor has in both the operations, but also in the decision making that gives rise to the alleged fraud. And so there should be you know, careful diligence around understanding the function of the target company's compliance program, and obviously the disclosure of risks. But a recognition that to the extent that the private equity sponsor is involved in the core and substance of the decision making that gives rise to the allegations of fraud, that's where the government is going to pay some particularly close attention. Reid, anything to add on this last point?
Yeah, I want to, you know, pound the table on the due diligence issue. I mean, we're going to talk about it a little bit more later on in this presentation, but I think it's really important to emphasize that to the extent that your private equity client or your manufacturer or device maker is looking at making an acquisition of a product, having your FDA expertise at hand, having your healthcare reimbursement expertise at hand, so that the client can really model what is the secret sauce for the success of the product. Is it efficacy? Is it a pricing model that's reimbursement based, that has some aspect to it that once you take it over and it's yours, you may find doesn't fit within the compliance risk parameters in which you operate, and that you have to adjust it. And if you adjust it, then if the profitability of the product may be implicated, you know, so, you know, that is something that, you know, really, you know, you want to have the right tools in place during the due diligence process so that your clients are going to be able to understand what sliding scale factors may be impacting profitability and revenue. Because when you look at this, you know, the case that Amin is talking about, the PE acquirer got tagged for an additional $1.5 million, which was post-acquisition alleged damages. And so either the acquirer, you know, chose to continue practices without understanding what the risk was, or just chose to continue the practice because that was what was working. Either way, the government came in and, you know, imposed, you know, a financial sanction on the acquirer for post-acquisition activity. And I think that's very noteworthy.
Yeah, I can't agree enough that that is the key, is a recognition that it is not blind investment. There's an expectation of knowledge, expectation that that if activity continues under your watch as an investor, you can be held liable. Next slide. As we move over to the next slide, I think we're just passing on the CLE code, which is 21721. Again, it's 21721. And with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Reid.
Thanks, Edmund. Let's have one more slide. So we're going to talk about some of the things that we've been touching on already, which are, what are the priorities that we can see from the Biden administration, from the Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate, and from the states in the area of fraud and abuse in life sciences? We really, really need to level set based on an understanding that there was a very significant change that took place on January 20th when the Biden administration came into office. And it's going to have not really a ripple effect, but really a tidal effect on enforcement priorities across all industries. And I'm sure you all are being inundated with webinars across multiple industries talking about how enforcement priorities are going to take a 180 in any particular industry. And so in our life sciences space, that will be no different. So where's the Biden administration really been focusing? Obviously, the pandemic is top priority for the Biden administration. The vaccine distribution, diagnostic testing for COVID, access to PPE, those are all extremely high priorities for the Biden administration to get the country effectively back on track after a year of having to manage these pandemic issues. So what are the issues that are the fraud and abuse issues that are bubbling up there? Well, there's the risk of counterfeit products, a lot of counterfeiting of PPE, a lot of concern about the quality of masks, a lot of concern about all sorts of protective equipment and whether or not what's being spent, the enormous sums of government money at the state and federal levels that are being spent to try to protect the public are being dollars well spent. We are seeing counterfeit vaccine concerns arising as unscrupulous people are labeling different substances and selling them to whoever they can, and then testing efficacy, making sure that the tests that are available are really going to be effective to the level at which they're claimed. So the Biden administration, may in some respects seem preoccupied with the pandemic response because it is such a visible priority for, for the administration and for the public. But there are other issues that already are going to be high on the list of considerations because the Democratic Congress has been raising these types of issues as much as the Trump administration was. So what's one of those issues? Well, drug pricing litigation has been initiated over the Trump administration's drug pricing rule. And that's the rule that took 18 months, maybe 2 years, really, to move from idea that was being floated by the Trump administration in 2018 to actually being implemented as an interim rule at the very tail end of the administration. And what am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about the International Price Index Most Favored Nation concept that was intended by the prior administration to force down prices for a specific subset of particularly costly Medicare drugs. And, obviously the blunt force approach of just trying to impose a new pricing framework on top of the drug distribution chain, development and distribution chain, was going to raise a lot of hackles and create a lot of concerns. And so the latest on this is reflected in the litigation. In December, the district court in Maryland granted the motion for TRO from the industry based on an APA theory that the the executive branch had not followed proper notice and comment in trying to speedily implement this most favored nation rule before leaving office. Next slide, please. So the Medicare Part B drugs that were going to be impacted were actually effectively saved from the rule when on December 28th, a district court in the Northern District of California, in a similar case, issued a nationwide preliminary injunction against the implementation of the most favored nation model. And if you look on the CMS website today, or if you look on it yesterday, as I did, you'll see that the administration currently, or the bureaucracy, let's call it the bureaucracy, or the deep state, if you will, before we see what the Biden administration is going to do, has decided that they've effectively thrown in the towel and that the most favored nation model isn't going to be implemented. Obviously, it wasn't in January, and it won't be without further rulemaking. So that was a major victory for pharma. And when I say pharma, I mean the industry, not the industry group, because of benchmark that was made with the court that these types of dramatic changes to the distribution model and the business model for drug development, pricing, and the sort of incentives that exist down the supply chain are not going to be just swept away in any one fell swoop without a lot of very careful consideration, buy-in from stakeholders. Next slide, please. Now, just because the litigation in the MFN cases was successful for the industry side, that doesn't mean that there isn't going to be an inordinate amount of scrutiny on the issue of drug pricing, because there was before the Biden administration came in to office, and there continues to be because Congress has a preoccupation with drug pricing dating back to 2014 when many of us were working on congressional inquiries directed at generic drug manufacturers over what were alleged to be monopolistic pricing approaches where markets for certain drugs dropped to a level of two competitors or less, in which case the government took the position that the pricing for those products in that category could be subject to effectively monopolistic types of behaviors. And so since then, whether it be a Republican majority in the Senate or a Democratic majority in the Senate, the House, again, whether there's a Republican House majority or a Democratic House majority, there is always going to be an appetite for high theater in Congress about drug pricing. And so you can see from this particular slide that in October, late September, early October, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform continued on its tradition of pursuing and shaming manufacturer executives over what they not so subtly like to entitle unsustainable drug pricing. And so we're going to continue to see those types of hearings crop up, because at this point, the staff of these standing committees, which have subpoena power, are very adept at knowing where to go to find what's happening in the marketplace for high revenue, high cost drugs for the Medicare program. And they know the playbook of how to figure out where perceived abuses can be identified. And they're very adept at turning them into, like I said, theater for public consumption on C-SPAN. And one of the things to always keep in mind about these types of congressional investigations is the lack of protection that subjects of these investigations have from the publication of their confidential and proprietary information. Amin, you've been in a number of these investigations. You want to chime in on the risks that entities have?
I'm hoping that my mute has unmuted.
You're good.
I'm good. Okay. Sorry, I think I'm having technology issues here. Yes, absolutely. So, you know, when you're sitting in front of any number of committees on the House or Senate side, there are undoubtedly concerns about confidentiality. And the reality is that the default is for information that's shared with these committees to become part of the public sphere. And so when we're looking, you know, at how we interact with the committees in an oversight role, it is essentially a calculus around what information the company wants to see ultimately in the public sphere, and an expectation that confidentiality is going to be very hard to maintain. That does mean that we fight very hard when we're navigating these investigations to limit the scope of the request to the most narrow universe of information. But again, the ways in which that information might be used against you needs to be anticipated. So it is a very careful dance around providing a level of cooperation to avoid drawing the ire of the committee chairperson, but also understanding that that you don't want to be in the headlines the next morning.
Yeah, absolutely. And then in particular with drug pricing issues, you know, our experience has been that the staff, depending on the subject of the investigation or the hearing and the particular headline that is being sought, staff may be willing to heed, you know, concerns relating to the confidentiality of statutory price information like average manufacturer price, which, you know, has real competitive implications. And so, you know, if you are able to, whether working on behalf of just your client or working in a coalition, common interest group with other manufacturers, come up with alternative data that could satisfy the staff and the members so that they can still get their headline without having to give away you know, the most sensitive information, you know, those are opportunities that need to be explored. Next slide, please. So, you know, another very ripe hearing topic is, of course, opioids. And again, oversight and reform, now led by Carolyn Maloney, was in December holding hearings on opioid allegations around Purdue and OxyContin, which swept up McKinsey Consulting. And, you know, this is, you know, we're noting this really to make sure that hub vendors, consultants, other business advisors, you know, who are working with life sciences companies on business strategy understand that when Congress starts to turn its spotlight on a product, a disease state, a device, or anything of that nature, they're going to pull that thread as hard as they can. Again, once until they reach the point where they can get their headline. And so we see now McKinsey announcing a $600 million resolution with a number of states over its role in the giving advice to manufacturers about how to market and strategize around OxyContin. One of the other things that's important, let's move on to the next slide, because I think these two points are going to dovetail. So state legislative scrutiny on drug prices. Again, everything flows together. Everything is one big hub and spoke, with every issue leading back to the hub. And so you've got the McKinsey settlement that was announced weeks ago. But I was reading this morning, as many of you probably read, that municipalities and cities who have asserted claims in the opioid litigation are saying that McKinsey's settlement with the 49 states that signed on with their deal doesn't include them. And so one of the things you really want to make sure you're addressing with your stakeholders within your company or with your clients is, what do these large multi-state settlements, these quote unquote global settlements, really represent? And these days, it's often hard to find a global settlement that's truly global. Maybe we call them intercontinental, but not necessarily global, because it's very difficult to get all of the stakeholders on the plaintiff side to get aligned with the idea of ending litigation early or without trial. And so you really need to make sure that decision makers understand that they may be eliminating a large piece of litigation with one of these big multi-state settlements, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all their exposure is going to disappear, or that all their litigation is going to disappear, or that even the scope of the discovery for the subject matter is going to be meaningfully limited if you still have a number of municipalities or cities sprinkled out there with their plaintiff law firms representing them going for the jugular still. And on top of that, we've got the legislative developments on drug pricing that continue to roll out. Over the past number of years, we've seen a number of initiatives, some blocked by litigation brought successfully by pharma and other trade associations, and some not, that is intent on requiring manufacturers to effectively publicize price and justify price increases on an annual basis at the state level. And now there's been a new raft of bills introduced in states like Hawaii, Maine, and Washington that would literally seek to impose taxes on drug price increases. And, these are, in a sense, the offspring of the CPIU pricing penalty that attaches to the Medicaid drug rebate program. But they are blunt instruments that are intended to really discourage manufacturers from the typical price increases that they would bring to bear. And we're seeing in other states, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, more legislation that we're going to have to watch very carefully, involving not just prices paid by government payers like Medicaid, but also commercial health plans for ever-expanding lists of drugs that are slapped with the label of being too expensive, excessively costly, or high-priced. And so we need to really, on an ongoing basis, keep track of these legislative developments, because, again, they also imply that sensitive price information may be required to be produced to these states. And so the continuing rearguard action on protecting the confidential and proprietary nature of manufacturer price information around R&D, marketing, and sales, and other types of internal activities that support the products are going to have to continue. Next slide, please. Okay, so let's talk about risk-based activities in transactions. You know, we're going to talk, we're talking in the context of M&A or asset acquisition, buying a product, in licensing a product. What is your mindset for your due diligence checklist? How do you approach the exercise so that you can properly quantify the risk, if it's, if any significant risk is being undertaken in acquiring the product? So what's the strategic objective for the acquisition? Is this just an asset? Are we buying the whole company? If we're buying an asset, do we have the human resources to and the experience to manage the product? You know, familiarity with the disease state and the competition. If we're buying the whole company, are we planning on keeping the talent that we need to manage the further development of the product? If it's a fairly new product and not a very mature one, if there are additional indications that are, that we're aspiring to, have, do we have the right people in place? Do we have the right quality operational systems in place to manage the product effectively and safely? So, you know, what's the strategy for realizing the value for the asset? Is it short term or is it long term? You know, if the acquisition is for a company that is going to be set up for, you know, a PE buyer down the road or for a company that's going to be spun off, what kind of compliance infrastructure is in place so that when the next buyer, potential buyer is looking at the asset, they'll feel comfortable that they're able to properly, you know, quantify any risks. If the product of the asset or the company are going to be kept, you know, how easily can it be integrated? How different is it from the products that your company already sells? Is it a specialty drug, an injectable, a Part B drug, a biosimilar that's very different from Part D drugs that your company might make? So those are all issues that really should get their tires kicked very hard in the process of assessing an acquisition. If an IPO is being planned for the company, you really need to, you know, look at what is expected of a public company when you start thinking about the roadshow and what kind of questions are going to be asked about manufacturing, quality assurance, sales and marketing, projections, and the like. So what is the focus on the due diligence going to be to ensure that the price and the value and the future value are being correctly estimated? And then if the buyer is going to manage the acquired asset rather than the PE investor, we need to deal with the issues that Amin was talking about in the context of making sure that the PE sponsor is not being unduly put at risk by the way it's managing or plans on managing the company, the portfolio company, or the asset. Next slide, please. Right. So again, I just alluded back to the Therakos case. Other key issues for post-closing due diligence, distribution, marketing, patient access programs, particularly for products that haven't been launched yet. You know, having your pricing committee be on the same page with the prior company's management on how that product pricing was set. Next slide. So having the right reps and warranties obviously is important. Specific reps on compliance with the full range of fraud abuse laws, knowledge of threatened or pending government investigations or litigation, and having the right survivability for the reps and warranties. Indemnification provisions, if, you know, having the right strength to protect the buyer, and if you can get an escrow for known identified risks, that's also, you know, very advisable. Next slide. So let's switch over to Amin and hear about what the OIG is focusing on as relevant to pharma and devices.
Great. Thanks so much, Reed. And we'll go through this section fairly quickly, given that we're coming up on time. But this really brings us full circle to the trends that we're seeing, the issues that have been reverberating over the last couple of years. And this really is where the OIG puts pen to paper and identifies work plan priorities for enforcement activity in the year to come. So a recent special fraud alert on pharma speaker series, which we'll go through in some detail, a focus on drug prices, focus on medical device risk areas and diagnostic testing. As you can imagine, coming out of 2020, that was on the list. Next slide, please. So in terms of the special fraud alert, we'll spend some time on this very quickly. In November of 2020, OIG issued this fraud alert regarding fraud and abuse risk associated with speaker programs. So we talked about a number of the significant settlements in 2020. This really speaks to the level of attention this is going to continue to receive. Using data analytics, CMS identified that drug and device companies have paid nearly $2 billion to healthcare providers for speaker-related services 2017 through 2019. And so what this is focused on is any circumstance where a healthcare provider is providing a speech or a presentation to a group of other professionals on behalf of a drug or device company regarding a disease state or on behalf of the company. And what the alert points to is studies where these presentations have resulted in improper influence on clinical decision making. Next slide, please. So really getting into the nitty-gritty of what this means, OIG is focused on the potential for alternative forums, right? We've all been doing everything on Zoom and WebEx and everything in between. This is also a recognition that some of this information exchange doesn't have to happen in person. It doesn't have to happen at a fancy hotel or in the context of an in-person social event. So to the extent that a presentation is provided in person, there's going to be a heightened level of scrutiny and attention focused on why it needed to occur in person versus being done online or in another pre-recorded forum. The negative indicators that OIG is going to focus on, the sort of little or no substantive information actually being presented, the availability of alcohol or a meal at the event, whether the location is not conducive to the exchange of educational information. So a number of the cases that we've seen in recent years involve presentations occurring at restaurants, at bars, not in a conference room or another setting that maybe is more appropriate. The repetitive sponsorship without any meaningful substantive updates in the programming, the period of time between significant increase in the amount of information related to the particular product, and healthcare professionals attending programs on the same or substantially the same product more than once, or same topics more than once. So this is the checklist. To the extent that you have a speaker program, your clients have a speaker program, these are the touch points that are going to be viewed with a microscope in the coming year and beyond. Reed, anything to add there before we move on?
No, that's really it. It's been a long time coming, and now here we are.
Okay, next slide. Given where we are in time, we're not going to go into much detail here. I'll just ask that if folks have questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to Reed or me. But this is really the continuation of the priorities around post-market surveillance of medical devices, a real focus on price and price differential, this comparison of average sales price and average manufacturer prices. OIG is going to be looking for mechanisms where lower prices may be reimbursed if there's a trend that's identified a real scrutiny around eligibility, Medicare Part C and Part D providers, focus on Medicare Part D or compound drugs, supplier acquisition costs, and just general control around fraud, waste, and abuse specific to orthotic braces, so in the DME space. With that, I'm going to hand off to Reid to take us home.
Thanks, Simon. So I just want to, you know, spend a minute talking about value-based contracting. Next slide, please. Let's advance it too. Thanks. So, you know, value-based contracting is obviously a very innovative approach to getting manufacturers of devices and drugs aligned with payers and prescribers. And the idea of having an outcomes-based approach to drive the value and the prescribing decision and the coverage decision really implicates a whole host of questions that I think no one really has the answer to right now. The sprint for value, you know, approach of the government always raises more questions than it answers. And I think all we can say at the moment because of time is that value-based contracting has got to be approached very carefully and prudently. There are a lot of great ideas, and they do represent real opportunities for partnership between you know, payers and PBMs and manufacturers, but the incentives need to be looked at very carefully so that they don't unduly implicate anti-kickback issues. So with that, I'll say thank you so much for spending a large chunk of your afternoon with us. If we move this slide one more, I can give you the CLE code again. What, there we go, 21721. And please look forward to our next outreach on the next in our series of healthcare and life sciences. And thank you again.